Radio Symphony Orchestra conducted by Esa-Pekka Salonen. And so this edition of Sunday Morning draws to a close. I do hope you found it interesting and thank you so much for listening. Next week, James Jolly is back with his own choice selection. I'll be listening at home while raiding my own shelves for my next appointment with you, which will be in 3 weeks' time. That programme on June the 8th will include Beethoven's Fourth Violin Sonata, played by Arthur Grumio and Claudio Arauer, and an hour of music inspired by the Scottish Muse and a performance by the New York Philharmonic of the Third Symphony by the first female composer to win the Pulitzer Prize for Music, Ellen Taef Zwillich. It's a lovely piece. In the meantime, enjoy your listening and do join James next Sunday, same time, 9 o'clock, here on BBC Radio 3.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Neil Miners.
From advertising and film to the dreaded putting you on hold music, Vivaldi's Four Seasons find their way into almost every part of our everyday lives. Get inside this Baroque masterpiece as violinist Simon Standage joins the English Concert to bring these iconic concertos to life in what promises to be a virtuoso period performance. And in the second half, soprano Lucy Crowe sings two of Handel's brilliant early Italian cantatas. Join me, Martin Handley, for Vivaldi and Handel, live in concert on Wednesday at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3, or listen in high-definition sound via the Radio 3 website.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's just after midday. Time now for Private Passions. And Michael Barclay's guest is the businesswoman Emma Bridgewater.
Nearly 30 years ago, Emma Bridgewater, a young English graduate, went shopping for a cup and saucer for her mother's birthday present. She couldn't find anything she liked, so she designed one herself and enjoyed the process so much that she installed a kiln in the bathroom of her flat in Brixton. That small bathroom kiln has grown into a company with an annual turnover of £11 million and has revitalised the old potteries industry of Stoke-on-Trent. Her teapots and mugs, covered in polka dots, hens, dogs and birds, have become a staple of many a kitchen. And I can't help wondering, Emma, whether you feel that a lot of your success is based on a almost primal yearning we all feel for a sort of comforting vision of home.
Oh, gosh, we need that vision of home, don't we? And perhaps the more frantic our lives become, the more we need it. And what I've discovered is people care a lot about their domestic china. It's quite a girl thing. But we choose the china that we use every day with great care. And there's something about the fact that it's always there through all the good times and bad, sort of always a part of family life, that means in the end it does seem to acquire great significance, and we like passing it on, don't we? I mean, I love using both things that belong to my grannies.
Do you think we do have a vision of what we would like our sort of homes to be? Is vision the right word?
Well, I think some people are very good at the vision thing and tremendously creative and can look at a house in a state of advanced squalor and see it as the home of their dreams, and others are really hopeless at it. So
is your home in a state of advanced squalor, or is it very tidy?
Yes, I've just confessed, haven't I? Certainly, whenever Matthew and I have moved, our houses have always been described by the estate agents as in need of total modernisation.
There is, I think, a very English, a pleasing English sensibility to your designs, and perhaps it's that sense of Englishness that also appeals to you in the first music.
I am so completely English through and through, yes.
One of your sons, I think, has a direct relationship to this piece too.
I've got three girls and a boy. Michael, the youngest, is 14, and he was a chorister in Oxford. He was at Christ Church. And it was so exciting for me as someone without a musical education and without, I mean, I've really got tin ears, watching him aged 8 when he started, dive in to choral music. And this was a song that he particularly loved. So I've had this very, very nice thing of learning about music, often through sort of eavesdropping on my children, as it were.
It's Benjamin Britten and Balu Lalo from The Ceremony of Carols.
Gosh, that's lovely, isn't it?
It's a wonderful sound, and of course, sitting in a beautiful cathedral listening to it is also very inspiring. That was Balu Lalo from Benjamin Britten's A Ceremony of Carols, performed by the boys of Worcester Cathedral Choir, conducted by Adrian Lucas. The soloist was David Hardwick, and the harpist, Brian Davis. We talked earlier, Emma Bridgewater, about a yearning for home, and whatever that is. And your mother, who inspired the first cup and saucer, however it came into existence. And she's clearly a huge influence on your work. But sadly, there's a terrible tragedy there as well, isn't there?
Yeah, poor mum. She went out hunting one day and didn't come back, really, ever again. And the horse fell on the road. She had very, very bad injuries from that, and she lived for another 22 years in a very shadowy state. And in that 22 years, she died just before Christmas. There was a very strange thing of having to almost struggle to assert what she'd been like before the accident, because she was such a sad shadow of herself after the accident. And there's a very difficult thing. You can't grieve for someone while they're alive, but she was gone. And so you had to sort of hold on to what she was. And in a way, that's, I think, what I was doing in my work a lot of the time.
Yes, I know a very similar case. And the trouble is that you don't know whether it would be better for that person to be alive or dead, because part of them is dead and another part of them is alive.
It's a torture and a trial that I suppose an awful lot of people go through a version of. I mean, it was as if she got advanced Alzheimer's, sort of bang. It was just a very long, long struggle. But it's a very, very strange thing when the person you love has gone, but they're still there. You've still got a duty of care, but none of what you've always had from them.
So was your work very helpful to you during this period? Something to really immerse yourself in?
Oh, yes. I feel hugely lucky that I was 31 when it happened. I was married. I got 2 small children. And the business was very absorbing. So, I mean, it didn't always feel like a good thing to have a lot of extra on one's plate. But it is always a good thing. Work saves you, doesn't it? It's always a good thing.
Well, sometimes music is also kind of cathartic, isn't it?
Oh, gosh, yes. It plays such a vital part of my life. And the next song, Shenandoah, really reminds me of Mum. She had a huge repertoire of this kind of song, and she could sing all the way from Oxford to Northumberland in the car.
Do you think she'd been part of the US Navy band Sea Chanters Chorus?
I think she'd have liked to be.
Ooh,
they
wouldn't.
Sound so handsome, don't they?
Oh, Shenandoah, I long to hear you away, your rolling river.
Shenandoah, performed by the U.S. Navy band Sea Chanters Chorus, the official choir of the American Navy. Both for you and for your mother, for you never know how these intergalactic ability to communicate works. We'll put a picture of the gentleman of that chorus on the Private Passions webpage.
I think she'll be very, very glad of that. I certainly will.
When your business took off, Emma Bridgewater, you made a deliberate decision to make your china in Stoke-on-Trent, as I said at the beginning. And unlike other companies in Britain who often manufacture abroad, was it difficult to do that?
I mean, really, it's a lot simpler. It's just a short train ride. I'm always rather astonished at the sort of alacrity with which people rush abroad. I've been so grateful not to have to go abroad to sort out production problems. Mm. So, I mean, in lots of pragmatic ways, it's rather a good
thing. But it must be very rewarding, A, to feel that you're providing jobs in that area, but also that you're providing an English product that is made in England.
Both, definitely. I mean, for me, I sort of dimly apprehended something about Stoke-on-Trent. I sort of, the Industrial Revolution, memories of history, O-levels and that kind of thing. When I got there, I was entirely unprepared for the terrible mess that the Industrial Revolution has left in the Midlands, the post-industrial depression, the extraordinary skills that are embedded in that place, the tradition that lives on there. So many things came at me as a complete surprise. And I think my commitment started kind of almost instantaneously. I also felt an enormous romantic attraction to these big Victorian factories, so many of them lying empty, and longed to put the lights back on in one of them. I then realised when I started work there that the people are remarkable despite terrible hardship. And, you know, it's not just the pottery industry that's gone, but coal and steel. A very, very bad economic decline, long-term unemployment for quite large numbers of people. I mean, we're talking two or three generations or four generations in some cases now, of continuous unemployment. And that's the chaos that makes is dreadful. And yet somehow it's the most spirited, funny, lovely place.
You radiate a niceness and a sensitivity, and yet running a big business must sometimes demand an element of ruthlessness. You know, people have to be sacked and whatever.
Yes, the word that Matthew, my husband, to describe me is probably most often relentless. I don't think I get angry and dance about, but I do have a sort of steely purpose. And once I'm on a quest, I'm quite keen to follow it through.
This next piece, I think, has a visual connection, although, of course, it wasn't originally written to be part of the soundtrack of a film.
But it's such a good film. It's the soundtrack to Master and Commander, which I approached with caution because I was very, very, very deeply romanced by Patrick O'Brien and dreaded that the books would be murdered. So I was just bowled over by it. I thought it was completely wonderful. And the person who put me on to Patrick O'Brien heard that I was very devoted to Georgette Heyer, which I indeed am. And he said, if you like Georgette Heyer, you'll absolutely love Patrick O'Brien. And there's a sort of secret society of people who like both those things, I'm inclined to believe. And I hadn't exactly analysed why I love them so much. And another friend said, oh, yes, you use them for homesickness. he said, my aunt gave me two Georgette Heyers when I went away to school. I never needed them, but some of the boys used them a lot, as if they were sort of a patent remedy. And I realised that's exactly what they mean to me. So this piece of music, which is so lovely, has got elements of the lovely warm cloak that the books give me.
La Musica Notturna della Strade di Madrid by Boccherini. Night Music of the Streets of Madrid, the quintet by Luigi Boccherini, in an arrangement for the soundtrack to Master and Commander. The musicians there led by Richard Tognetti. Music to cure homesickness, Emma Bridgewater.
What I've found, I think possibly quite a lot of women who have to work away from home quite a bit, it's very difficult leaving small children at home. Even when you know they're in totally sort of good hands and they're happy and they hardly notice that you've gone. And I spent a great deal of time commuting from North Norfolk to the West Midlands, down to London and back to Norfolk every week. So far too many hours in the car and far too many nights in sort of travel lodge hotel rooms, which are enough to give absolutely anybody the pip. But I found as long as I had a Georgette Hare in my luggage, or indeed a Patrick O'Brien, that was totally fine. It keeps the world at bay.
Your last music was about the Master and the Commander, and this music is about Pirate Jenny. Can you explain?
Well, my stepfather was assistant director at the Citizens Theatre when there was a production of the Threepenny Opera in, I suppose, something like 69 or 70. And I guess he was learning it. There was a tape of it, I have to say, in English. But there was something about the swing of this song that my brother Tom and I used to hugely enjoy. When I think about this song now, it's quite sort of intriguing how much we liked it, because it's very subversive and sort of dark and dangerous, but I really loved that.
It's about getting revenge, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And perhaps, you know, so that particular thing of a girl who's feeling powerless, feeling quite cross, which has far more resonance now than I had any idea it would as a child. I just loved the way that chorus comes in. We used to love singing it to each other.
Meine Herren, heute sehen Sie mich Gläser abwaschen und ich mache das Bett für jeden. Und Sie geben mir einen Penny und ich bedanke mich schnell. Und Sie sehen meine Lumpen und dieses lumpige Hotel. Und Sie wissen nicht, mit wem Sie reden. Und Sie wissen nicht, mit wem Sie reden. Aber eines Abends wird ein Geschrei sein am Hafen und man fragt, was ist das für ein Geschrei? Und man wird mich lächeln sehen bei meinen Gläsern. Und man sagt, was lächelt die dabei? Und ein Schiff mit 8 Segeln und mit 50 Kanonen wird liegen am Kai. Man sagt, gewisch deine Gläser, mein Kind, und man reicht mir den Penny hin. Und der Penny wird genommen und das Bett wird gemacht. Es wird keiner mehr dann schlafen in dieser Nacht. Und sie wissen immer noch nicht, wer ich bin. Und sie wissen immer noch nicht, wer ich bin. Aber eines Abends wird ein Getös sein am Hafen und man fragt, was ist das für ein Getös? Und man wird mich stehen sehen bei meinem Fenster und man sagt, was lächelt die so bös? Und das Schiff mit 8 Segeln und mit 50 Kanonen wird beschießen die Stadt. Und es werden kommen 100, gehen Mittag an Land und werden in den Schatten treten und fangen einen jeglichen vor jeglicher Tür und legen ihn in Ketten und bringen ihn vor mir und fragen, welchen sollen wir töten? Und fragen, welchen sollen wir töten? Und an diesem Mittag wird es still sein am Hafen, wenn man fragt, wer wohl sterben muss. Und dann werden sie mich sagen hören, alle. Und wenn dann der Kopf fällt, sag ich, hoppla. Und das Schiff mit 8 Segeln und mit 50 Kanonen Leben wird entschwinden mit mir.
You particularly like that recording?
Yes, I should hastily add that Tom and I were not singing to each other in German. he will definitely be very surprised if he thought that was what I was saying.
Pirate Jenny from Act One of the Threepenny Opera, music by Kurt Weill and words by Bertolt Brecht. We heard Ute Lemper as Polly with John Mauchery conducting the Berlin Sinfonietta. And by the way, all of Emma Bridgewater's choices are available on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. You probably get asked very frequently about running a business and having four children. Not a question that is ever addressed really to men.
It's funny that, isn't it? But that's because I don't find the sort of implication of that problematical. It seems to me that it acknowledges the fact that for women, you really do feel torn if you've got children and you're working. Whereas I do notice that dads are less afflicted by that, which is probably lucky for the economy. And it's probably just as well for family life that at least one of the parents is a bit heart-torn at leaving the children. But it is a terrible feeling.
Well, it's nice, half. Yeah, nice to be able to say that you're good for the economy.
Well, in our small way, I wish we employed 2,500 people in Stoke.
More music. And this, I have to say, of course, it's a tragic piece. And many people do choose music that has a sort of tragic quality to it. But it is probably one of the most frequently requested pieces. It's Dido's Lament from Purcell's Dido and Aeneas. And a plea to be remembered.
It's almost unbearably poignant, isn't it? I'm aware I seem to have chosen quite rather sort of serious things. But yes, it's funny, the how much one wants to think about being remembered. And I suppose it is something of a theme for me. I love both my grandmothers. I think about them. I use their things. I feel that we yearn to be remembered affectionately, don't we?
What's wonderful in this is the way Purcell takes the words remember me and makes them the absolute top of the sort of emotional cycle. And then he repeats it and puts it up, and so it absolutely pierces the heart.
Pierces. I mean, it is almost unbearable. And it's so pure, isn't it?
Thank you.
And that is exactly what happens, isn't it? When someone dies, you do forget their fate and remember them. We had the most wonderful funeral for Mum, and all the sad, bad stuff rushes away and the real person rushes back. And it's so simple.
I often wonder whether Purcell or, for example, Gluck, or any of these composers who write something utterly memorable, know at that moment of composition, that's going to go down well.
Oh, I don't doubt it.
I'm sure.
That glorious moment.
The closest I get to it occasionally makes me feel that sort of, just a faint touch of what that might be like.
Well, the word that comes to me is pure. It feels so strong, simple and pure.
We heard Dido's Lament from Purcell's Dido and Aeneas, sung by Janet Baker with the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Anthony Lewis. Was she a particular favourite, Janet Baker, for you?
I just love the power and simplicity of her voice, yes. Love that.
Russia is, I think, behind the next choice, and a particular visit there.
Yes, a marvellous friend called Clem Cecil took Matthew and I and a group of people to visit these very, very extraordinary brick churches built at the end of the 18th century, which are in total disrepair. And it's in Tver province, sort of halfway between St. Petersburg and Moscow on that high-speed train. And we were met by a driver and we went bucketing off down those sandy roads for about 150 miles. And I've never felt so remote. And we bounced around in a minibus and looked at several of these churches with birch trees growing in the roofs. And yet most of them have a congregation, and the survival of the church there was tremendously moving. And while we were in one of them, these three women came and went into the winter church. We were standing in the high summer church talking about restoration and, you know, how we were with quite a lot of architects and that kind of thing. These three women went on singing the evening offices, and that was very extraordinary.
So we're going to hear the Gretchaninov Creed. Was that a piece you actually heard, or just one that you...
Do you know,
liked?
I don't know what we heard, but I sort of have been hunting around since, and it sort of stands for quite a lot of things for me, this, in that Mum's father was a clergyman, so church has always been quite a strong part of my life. And sometimes, you know how this goes, the sort of tide goes in and out, and one can feel quite out of touch with it. And there was something about seeing the really advanced adversity in which faith survives moved me tremendously.
There's something quite extraordinary about hearing those choirs and those very rich, deep Russian basses. And there's nothing like going past the open doors of a Russian church or cathedral and hearing this sound emanating from within.
Вседержителя, Творца неба и земли, видим им же всеми невидимим. Его единого Господа Иисуса Христа, Сына Божия, единородного, и же от Отца рожденного прежде всех век. Света от света Бога истинно, Бога истинно, рожденно, несотворенно, единосущно Отцу, им же Marie Devi,
That setting of the Creed by Alexander Gretchaninov was performed by the Sofia Orthodox Choir, conducted by Miroslav Popsevov. The soloist was Nikolai Guzelev. I think that was played at the wedding of Prince Charles and Camilla, if I remember correctly.
Well, how very sensible. How sensible of them. It's absolutely lovely, isn't it?
Well, you're quite a supporter of the royal family because you've always enjoyed making pottery to commemorate royal weddings, royal babies. And in fact, they're bestsellers for the public, aren't they?
Oh, yes. Royal events are moneymakers for Stoke-on-Trent. The Staffordshire Potteries have always looked carefully to see if there was a wedding coming or a baby. Mm-hmm. And they mean jobs.
Even that music had a rather sad tinge to it, didn't it? And of course, not just the one that associated it with the buildings that were distressed, but there is a kind of yearning quality.
Well, I think about that a great deal, and I know I seek out music that captures that. And people ask about sort of inspiration, and inspiration in its sort of purest form is yearning. And I know that what I'm trying to do in a completely small scale, sort of domestic framework, is express that feeling of wanting to communicate my ideas about domestic life. It feels to me like it's the greatest privilege to work at something that enables you to do that. And making, I think there's a whole making sort of enigma. I think as a society, as we make less, we possibly that yearning increases. I think we distance ourselves from the nitty-gritty.
And interestingly, this next piece draws together two of those strands, because you like to play it in the kitchen, I think, when you're cooking, but it also has enormously emotional connotations for you, doesn't it? The Pergolesi Stabat Mater.
Absolutely. It's rather terrible to confess to making the lunch listening to this, because it's such a serious, meditative piece.
Well, many people probably will be making the lunch if they listen to us and the music we're about to play them. So
exactly. It's one of the nicest places to be, of course, in one's kitchen. And, usually there are lots of people around, but sometimes you're on your own. And what happened to me was in December, it was a very, very serious time. I responded, I know, when I picked up this CD that was in the house, because Michael, my son, had been learning, and there are many settings of it. It's often sung as a choir, and he'd learnt it, and so it was around. And I didn't know it very well, and it suited my mood, and I wanted something that hadn't been, how some of the music you really love becomes stained with sadness. And a lot of the Christmas music that I love was just too sad from previous Christmases. Mum's accident happened at Christmas. Both her mum, who I absolutely adored, and her father died in December. And this was sort of, I didn't feel sad. I felt very, very moved that her trouble was over.
Interesting that, in a sense, a sad piece can be more uplifting than actually jolly music, because it has jolly connotations that Christmas is spent, you know, carols and things.
Well, yes, exactly. Carols are really confusing for me. As I say, they've got sort of sad associations with sort of the time of her accident. But yes, they're sort of rollicking things. Whereas this was, somehow I came to it clean at a time when I was feeling very thoughtful. And it is a strange thing. Her death was a tremendously big, positive event for me. And I did feel immediately that she was free and that I was 22 years younger. And this is what this is about.
Thank you. The opening of the Pergolesi Stabat Mater Dolorosa, performed by James Bowman and Emma Kirkby. Christopher Hogwood was conducting the Academy of Ancient Music. That is very affecting, that music, for one particular reason, one technical reason, Emma. I don't know whether this would mean anything to you, but it has these, what we call in music, suspensions. That's to say, where one voice holds a note and the other either rises or descends to the note next to it. And then the first voice slightly gives way, but momentarily you have that very satisfying friction, like rubbing an itch.
It's very extraordinary. And then, it is intended as a meditation, isn't it? Perhaps that's exactly the effect that that has upon one. It hooks you emotionally very sort of closely.
And also in something that's dealing with pain and the Mother of God's pain, as it were, watching her son on the cross, to have something which has a friction that has to be resolved and repeated over and over again is like something, well, it has dolorosa in the title, something which is very tearful.
Mm. Yes, and one of the things one yearns for is to find such a perfect expression that you couldn't possibly, I couldn't in a million years create for myself, but that explains to you magically, miraculously, how you feel.
To move on to something slightly more positive and somewhat ambitious, you've got a wonderful new project in your life, Emma Bridgewater, and it involves a castle in Oxfordshire.
I wish it was more of a castle. It's a grubby farm that we bought from one of the colleges, and it had reached a very, very advanced state of dereliction by the time we bought it.
So this is your Russian church, as it were.
Yeah, I think it probably is. What I realised after we bought it, it's a tiny bit like the Stoke project too. I do dearly love a ruin. This isn't quite a ruin, but close. And we're doing all kinds of work there.
Is there something that you strive for, we're talking about yearning, that actually, which gives you particular satisfaction of being able to be creative in circumstances which are perhaps somewhat desolate or falling to pieces or need some injection of energy and love?
Yeah, that's a terrifically dynamic situation for me, definitely. I've always found a ruin, a decay, a place that's falling to pieces, it beckons to me very, very powerfully. And it's a strange feeling. When I went to the house first without Matthew, and just picture a lot of big corrugated iron and asbestos barns and a lot of mud and concrete. The farmhouse itself has got a little shard of an early medieval castle. It's the gatehouse. And the house is utterly, completely chaotic. Barely got electricity and sanitation. And I realised as I walked around it that I was completely doomed, that someone was going to have to sort this mess out, and oh dear, it was going to be us.
Well, luckily, you tend to get up early in the morning, but I think even there's a desolate streak to your life, because something that was very important to that process, that routine, is now sadly missing, isn't it?
Yes. Could we please bring back the UK theme tune? It was absolutely vital part of getting up early.
It was a sort of medley on tunes from the United Kingdom, arranged by Fritz Spiegel and Manfred Arlen. And it's a nice note on which to thank you very much, Emma Bridgewater, for sharing your private passions with us.
Thank you for asking me.
How very nice to hear that again. The Radio 4 UK theme, as arranged by Manfred Ahlen and Fritz Spiegel, and performed by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Paul Murphy. Michael Barclay's guest was Emma Bridgewater, and the producer was Elizabeth Burke for Loftus. And you can download that programme and many others if you go to the podcast page of the Radio 3 website. Michael's guest next Sunday is Laura Mavula, and that's at midday here on Radio 3.
It's 2 years since 15-year-old cellist Laura van der Heijden won the BBC Young Musician Final.
To play with such an amazing orchestra and such an amazing conductor is just the biggest privilege of all, really.
Once again, the three remaining contestants go head-to-head in the 2014 BBC Young Musician Final.
You get carried by the orchestra. They helped me and supported me in such a way that I could really be as free as I wanted to be.
Find out live who is the BBC Young Musician of 2014 this evening at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, the time is just after 1 o'clock. This is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90-93 FM, on digital radio and also online. Time now for the news summary. This is Jill Anderson in London. The Deputy Prime Minister, Nick Clegg, has said the government should scale back its Help to Buy scheme if told to by the Bank of England. The bank's governor, Mark Carney, has said booming house prices represent the biggest risk to financial stability. The Labour leader, Ed Miliband, has joined the criticism of Nigel Farage's comments about Romanians, although he said he didn't think the UKIP leader was a racist. In an interview last week, Mr Farage says he wouldn't want Romanians living next door to him. The Deputy Prime Minister, Nick Clegg, said it was a nasty view of the world. Efforts are underway to contain the next surge of the floods that are affecting hundreds of thousands of people in the Western Balkans. The Sava River has burst its banks in many towns and is now threatening the biggest power plant in Serbia. Huge swathes of neighbouring Bosnia are already underwater. Reports from Turkey say 18 people have been arrested as part of an investigation into last week's mining disaster. A number of those detained are said to be executives from the mining company which owned the mine. In all, 301 people died in the tragedy. North Korea has made a rare public apology for the collapse of an apartment building in the capital Pyongyang, in which many people may have been killed. State media showed still pictures of a cleared site where the building had been, and said officials expressed profound consolation and apologised. Voters in Switzerland appear to have rejected a proposal to give the country the world's highest minimum wage. Swiss trades unions say the move is long overdue, but the government and employers argue it could force small businesses to lay off staff. The Premier League has defended its working environment following a row about personal emails sent by the chief executive, Richard Scudamore, which made critical comments about women. A statement issued by the league said the matter would be discussed at a committee meeting tomorrow. And the weather. There's rain in Northern Ireland and Western Scotland. Elsewhere, it'll be warm and dry with highs of 23 degrees. And that's the BBC News and Weather at 3:30 after one. Well, coming up at 2 o'clock this afternoon, the early music show, and Lucy Skeeping will be talking to the musicologist Ian Gammy about the life of Charles Burney. But now we've a second chance to hear the live Radio 3 lunchtime concert given last Monday at Wigmore Hall by the London Concord Ensemble, a flexible chamber group of principals from top orchestras and ensembles. Their programme featured music by Prokofiev and Schoenberg, and it started with Mozart's Oboe Quartet. The oboist is Emily Palethorpe, a founding member of the group.